You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. I'm going to spend a couple of minutes really updating you what's happening in Syria, as well as the reaction to the reaction of the president to Russia's intervention in Syria. Now, the reason why I'm doing this is I hadn't intended to do another foreign policy show, but I think it's important to at least hear from the president as to what he's doing. And he was on 60 Minutes and was interviewed. I think this is the eighth time he's been interviewed by Steve Croft. It appears that Steve Croft is his favorite interviewer in the sense of a sit-down interviewer, and 60 Minutes does get a lot of attention, at least did. I don't own a television at home, so I don't watch television, period, except when I'm in the newsroom to see if there's any breaking news. So I didn't catch the live show. And it's somewhat difficult. If you go to YouTube, you'll get bits and pieces of it, but you're not really going to get the entire video. However, I did find online and for those that are new to my show, I need to point this out. I have a companion blog for the show. It's prontpops.wordpress.com. At the very top, you'll see a picture of me in the studio, but right underneath, you'll have links to the latest 60 to 80 shows, and below that, you'll have what I call my notes for the show, or my show prep, and that includes photographs, videos, articles, and in this case, I actually have the full transcript of the interview. And if you go to the link, you can watch the entire interview if you'd like. I have difficulty listening to him, quite frankly, and I admit it, because half of what he says is true, about another quarter is misleading, and about 25% of it is lies. And that just drives me nuts when you know the president is saying something that's simply not true. But this interview surprised a lot of people because Steve Croft actually was asking some very direct and pointed questions about his leadership, or lack of leadership, if you will, of President Obama in the Middle East. Now, it's clear to me that the president does not want to send troops back into Iraq as well as Afghanistan, extend the time that we're there. Now, there's something that needs to be said. I'm a non-interventionist, which means I don't want the United States to be policeman of the world. And for that matter, the American people have had it up to here sending troops to Iraq. And inevitably what happens is, especially after about the first 6 months to a year, instead of you being liberators, you become occupiers. And then they start shooting at you and planting bombs and killing your troops. And that's exactly what happened in Iraq. It's exactly what happened. Now, in Afghanistan, we weren't liberators. We were hunting down al-Qaeda. But we're going after the Taliban, and initially we were winning and the people loved us, but any army, foreign army, and it doesn't matter who, quickly becomes an occupying army. And the native people, the people that were born, raised, educated there, to the extent they have any education at all, really don't like Americans. Where it's beyond an ugly American, it's let's kill the Americans. And that means are soldiers, both our men and our women in uniform. And that's the problem with interventionism. We have a group in Congress called the neoconservatives. They're largely Republicans. They used to be part of the Democratic Party. But when George McGovern ran for president, took over the Democratic Party, many of those Democrats that were hawks on defense moved over to the Republican Party. They didn't feel welcome in the Democratic Party, and I can understand where they're coming from. The problem is why they're not a large group and really don't have a political base. They are consistent in arguing that the role of the United States should be a policeman of the world, should be expanding democracy. In other words, their default setting is intervention, anywhere and anywhere. The problem they have, the American people no longer support that. And now when President Bush was in office, Dick Cheney was the leading neocon in his administration. And he was supported by Rumsfeld and others. And as a result, we intervened in Iraq. Now, Al-Qaeda was not in Iraq. And Saddam Hussein was not supporting Al-Qaeda. There's absolutely no evidence of that. Yet, after doing some bombing and missions in Afghanistan, and there's not that much there anyway, the president, at the prodding of the neocon wing of the Republican Party, or at least the group, some of the leading senators are McCain and Lindsey Graham, but there are others. They wanted a war in Iraq. They felt that the first George Bush had not really completed the task of getting Saddam Hussein out of office. Now, I'm not supporting Hussein. He was a bad guy that deserved killing. He was a dictator, totalitarian, was killing his people, and he was a Sunni, so he went after the Kurds, he went after the Shiites. He ruled with an iron fist through fear, intimidation, coercion, torture, and killing. So I did not shed a tear when his regime fell, and ultimately he was captured and hung. As far as I'm concerned, good riddance. But the problem is this, whenever you intervene in a country like this, the United States can win the war, and we did win the war. But the people are expecting the United States to provide security in their local communities. That's police work, folks. They're expecting us to make sure that the electricity works. They want to make sure that they have clean water and sanitation. In other words, they want us to run the countries. And that's the problem. The military is not equipped to do that. It's simply not equipped. We're great at winning the battle or the war. We're not very good at winning the peace. And the problem is we had not totally defeated the Ba'athist Party members. We quickly made sure that no one that was a member of the Ba'athist Party could be in the government. But what that meant, you had a lot of unemployed people that now were against us. And the same thing happened in the Army. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have gotten rid of the top brass that were Ba'athist Party members, but if you wanted to hold a job of any responsibility in Iraq, you had to join the Ba'athist Party. So the first mistake was, and we try to convince the American people, well, it's like the Nazis after World War II. We need to denazify the government. So we got rid of all the Nazis. Well, we applied that in Iraq. As a result, your government functions were not being done, and we did it in the military. We quickly ran into a situation where we were fighting dissidents, primarily Sunnis as well as former Ba'athist Party, and immediately Al-Qaeda was attracted to go into Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq eventually is today the Islamic State. And for several years, it was clear that we weren't winning. We had the wrong generals, the wrong strategy, and it wasn't working. Ultimately, we had a surge of troops. We added more troops. We had a change in who was leading it, the change in strategy, and it was succeeding. And then we made a mistake. The Iraqi people had an election. They voted Malachi in, and I'm skipping over some details here, and he's a Shia. However, there's no love lost between the Shia and the Sunni, so he made sure that the army leadership did not have Sunni. They don't trust the Sunnis. And he made sure the militia went after the Sunnis, and the Sunnis responded in kind. So in effect, what you had was the makings of a new religious sectarian war between the Sunnis and the Shia. Then we did the surge. We got everything somewhat calmed down, even though there were still people being killed. And then Obama was elected president, and in 2011, the end of 2011, we pulled out, supposedly because we couldn't get a status of forces agreement, SOFA, SOFA. And why that's important is, and we have probably over 100 status of forces agreements with over 100 nations, problem, where you have U.S. servicemen and they commit crimes against the local population, it's only natural that the local government wants to try them. What the United States negotiates and has negotiated over the years is status of forces agreement, which in essence, bottom line is, if a U.S. serviceman commits a crime, usually what happens, he's on the next plane out to the United States. In other words, he's not sent to the local courts. That doesn't mean he's not court-martialed or punished, but it does mean he's never tried by the local courts. In this case, the Iraqi government courts. So when they couldn't negotiate or get agreement on it, Obama decided to use this as a pretext to pull out, and he did. He was told by generals that he would need, and you're going to get ranges of estimates, anywhere from 25,000 to 100,000 troops to stay there. And keep in mind, we still have 35,000 troops, for example, in South Korea. We still have troops on Okinawa and Japan. And World War II has been over for 69 years. You see, the problem, ladies and gentlemen, is this. Once you intervene in a country, why, the temptation is to get out quickly. And that was Donald Rumsfeld's strategy, to go in there with a relatively small force, unfortunately not enough, and that's why we needed the surge, and then get out as quick as possible. Well, that means you win the battle. I won't say win the war, you win the battles, and we did, but we were losing the war because you have the native population, the locals, whether Sunnis, Shia, attacking U.S. troops. So if you cut and run, which is in essence what Barack Obama did, you have exactly what you have now in Iraq. A vacuum develops, and who entered that vacuum? The Islamic State. That was, for all practical purposes, defeated in the surge. Remember, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was the problem, and we defeated them, mainly killed them, and the few that got away went to Syria. Many more were captured and in prison, ultimately were released. But now that they're arrested, recuperated, rearmed, they're now back in Iraq, and they control, I'd say at least a third of the country, mostly in the north and in the west, where the Sunnis are. And as a direct result of the United States pulling out, because the United States could have provided air support as well as armor support, tanks, artillery, that can defeat and destroy the Islamic State. And it could also provide training, equipment, and the rebuilding of the Iraqi army. But when we pulled out in 2011, most of our Air Force left. A lot of our equipment was left there, now is in the hands of the Islamic State. Not all of it, but a good chunk of it. And the point I'm leading up to is this. Once you intervene in any country, such as Iraq, a large-sized country, if you truly want to fight an insurgency war, and that's what we're fighting, you talk to the people that know all about that, they will tell you you're talking a minimum of 10 years and probably several decades before you can totally win that insurgency war. It's not going to happen overnight. Now, that doesn't mean you have to have hundreds of thousands of troops there forever, but it does mean you need to have a significant force on the ground in Iraq that can control the air and can provide training and support for the Iraqi army. And if you don't have that, and we don't, what happens? Because the majority population is Shia, and they don't trust the Sunnis, your national army is led by and is largely Shia. I'm not saying they're not some Sunni, but it's largely a Shia force. And it's difficult to get any Sunni to join that force because they are historically enemies. They hate each other. Now, I need to quickly say there have been periods when the Sunni and the Shia lived in peace, and they intermarry. But when you have initially Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that's now the Islamic State, that believes, and they're very much religious, they're Salafis, they believe that the Shia are heretics, and when they capture, especially Iraqi army or government officials, they kill them. They torture them and kill them. Many times on the spot, they'll pull out their weapons and shoot them in the head, or they'll cut their heads off. Now, I'm not saying the Shia are angels. They're not either. They do the same thing to Sunnis, and that's what we're up against. So the question is, what do you do? Do you commit American soldiers to be there for 10, 20, 30, 40 years? And I keep going back. We still have troops in South Korea. We still have troops in Japan. We still have some troops in Germany. And World War II ended, well, 69, 70 years ago. It's 70 years ago World War II ended in 1945. And we still have troops there. Now, what happened over time, our troops came home. The bulk of them came home, but we still have a presence. And that's something that's forgotten, that the cost of intervening is a long-term commitment, and you have to be prepared to make that commitment up front, and you need to tell the American people that. And that simply wasn't done. We never really had a plan for the peace. We had a plan for the war, but we didn't have a plan for the peace or a strategy to win the peace. And the result is the chaos that we have there today in Iraq. Now, getting back to 60 Minutes, I had to give that background. Because why President Obama would like to blame, and he's still blaming the Republicans for making the wrong decision about intervening there, every president, upon taking the oath of office, is dealt a hand of cards. And it's not a game, folks. Although I say it's a game of cards, you have to deal with the situation as it presents itself. And President Obama, within 2 years of being in office, made the decision, a political decision, to withdraw. And he did, as we're about to do in Afghanistan next year. The objective of President Obama is to get American troops, wherever they are, home. That was his campaign promise, and he wants it as his legacy that he was the president that got America out of Iraq and out of Afghanistan. Because of that, he does not want to intervene in any other country. Well, guess what? The enemies of the United States understand that. Our allies understand that. And there's a problem there. We have long-standing allies, including Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, that rely on the United States to provide them military equipment, which we sell them. In the case of Israel, they buy it from us. We give them military foreign assistance. In the case of Saudis, because they can afford it, they buy the equipment from us. But they're relying on the United States, ultimately, to defend them against threats. Now, the biggest threat in the Middle East today, up until recently, was the Islamic Republic of Iran. Unfortunately for the American people, Barack Obama agreed and negotiated with the leading state sponsor of terrorism, namely Iran. And this will lead, well, the immediate impact will be in the next year, they'll get upwards of $150 billion, even though Congress is trying to stop that. And that's going to be used, not entirely, but a good chunk of it is going to be used to engage in terrorist activities throughout the Middle East. And right now, where Iran is heavily involved, is supporting this Assad regime in Syria, as is Russia, as well as communist Chinese. Now, Iran likes to do everything through proxies, and their proxy there is Hezbollah. That is fighting and supporting and propping up, if you will, the Assad regime. Remember, they are Shia. Who are they fighting? Who are the rebels that are fighting and try to overthrow the Assad regime? They're Sunnis. And again, the majority are Sunnis. In western Syria, as well as northeastern Syria, that's where the majority are Sunni. There are pockets of Sunni in the southern portion as well. And what Assad is doing with the assistance now of Russia in terms of their various sorties or missions, they have attack as well as fighter aircraft that are attacking the Sunnis, the rebels, wherever they are. And most of the missions so far have been in, and I need to put a map in my post because it would be helpful. I don't have it up. I've done it in the past, but I'll add a map so you can see this. Assad is in Damascus, the capital, also along the coast, in the mountains along the coast. He's surrounded, not completely surrounded, but largely surrounded by rebels who are mostly Sunnis that are fighting them. Now, you need to know Russia, formerly the Soviet Union, has been a long-term ally of the Syrian regime. And they've been selling weapons to that regime for many, many years. That's why I agree with Obama. I'd like Assad out of office. But you have a problem. What the president likes, guess what? Russia and Iran don't. That's why they're supporting Assad. There is no transition there because the parties that are supporting Assad are not going to go home. And now what we have is Russia sent upwards of 50 aircraft, many fighters, many attack aircraft, as well as helicopters and tanks and troops are now in Syria to protect both their port, TARDIS, as well as a base that they have north of Damascus. So they are now heavily committed to Syria. In other words, they don't have the problems that the president has, or for that matter, Congress has, that the American people don't want any part of an intervention, a new intervention into Syria. They simply don't. And that reality needs to be faced. The reason why President Obama is getting criticism is because of he, in many ways, precipitated this. First, by drawing red line after red line, and you never do that unless you're really going to enforce it. If you're going to say, if you cross this line, we're going to stop you, then you better be prepared to stop the person. So the impression, and I think it's a correct impression, is, and the enemies of the United States know this as well as of our allies, they finally woken up to the fact that the United States has cut and run, wants no part, and by part I mean doesn't want ground troops to be stationed in Syria, Iraq, or anywhere else in the Middle East. That doesn't mean we might not send in a couple of hundred or a couple thousand special forces to assist the local regime, and that's what we've done. But that's far from deploying one or more divisions into a country, and that's what it takes. So what Putin has done is called Barack Obama's bluff and intervene. Now, I'm with Trump on this. If Russia wants to eliminate or destroy the Islamic State, go right ahead. It remains to be seen whether or not that's going to happen, because up to now, what the Russians have been targeting are the people that the United States was supporting by providing arms and some training. The problem is that has been proved a disaster. You know, Congress spent $500 million, over $500 million. To train and equip 5,000 troops in Syria to fight Assad. And we learn from the commander of CENTCOM, we only have 50, and most that we actually trained that were there, and only 5 are left. And their president was pushed on this by Steve Croft, and he more or less admitted that it's been a failure. He doesn't call it a failure. It just hasn't worked. You see, if your strategy is non-intervention or your foreign policy is non-intervention, you don't get involved with half measures. And that's what, in other words, we wasted another $500 million. Well, what's a $500 million here, a $500 million there? Well, it adds up and becomes real money, and it becomes a huge first budgetary deficit and debt. The American people don't want to waste their tax hard-earned money paid in taxes to equip people that either cut and run like they did in Iraq, taking off their uniforms, abandoning their equipment, and running for their lives, nor do we want to equip people that simply aren't successful. In other words, Americans want results, not excuses, results. See, the president's problem is he doesn't want to be clear, unequivocally clear, that the United States, even though we have many military bases and installations surrounding the Middle East, surrounding Iran, surrounding Iraq, doesn't want to admit that the United States, for all practical purposes, is out of the Middle East and will not be committing any more ground troops. In other words, it's up to you guys, and that's the message Barack Obama is sending. Now, he likes to use the term, and I think this is other BS, by the way. I sort of gagged. That's one of the reasons I can't listen to. Oh, the phrase is, and this is President Obama speaking, quote, over time, the community of nations will all get rid of them, and we will be leading getting rid of them. But we're not going to be able to get rid of them unless there is an environment inside of Syria and in portions of Iraq in which local populations, local Sunni populations, are working in a concerted way with us to get rid of them. What he's saying is, it's up to you guys. Don't look to us. And that's why it drives me nuts. This is a rather long paragraph. I'll parse it. It's up to you to do it. Oh, we'll help you. We'll give you some intelligence, some training, maybe some equipment. But it's up to you guys. And by the way, before we get involved, you got to get rid of Assad. Well, that's not going to happen as long as Russia and Iran and communist China are supporting Assad. In other words, this is an excuse not to do anything. And that's his problem. You got to have a clearly stated, what's your policy, what's your plan, and stick to it. And what he's saying is not really clear. The bottom line is, we're not going back, so don't expect us to go back. And guess what? Politically, that's what the American people support. I don't think we should send one soldier over there, and I'd cut off their money. Now, you need to get back, and I always bring it back to this. What is our national interest in Iraq? Let's broaden it. What's our national interest in the Middle East? What does the Middle East have that is a value to us and our allies and to Europe? Oh, that's not a hard question. It's oil. Matter of fact, I think that's probably one of the few, if only, national interests. It's natural resources, in this case, oil. In Iran's case, oil and natural gas, because they have a lot of natural gas. That's the only reason we should be there. Let me repeat, that's the only reason. And our long-term ally that has the lion's share of the oil in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia. Now, I didn't review the percentage of world reserves, but ballpark, Iraq and Iran, if they were fully producing, have about 10% of the reserves. I think the Saudis have upwards of 40%. I might be a little high there. So we need to definitely make clear that we will do everything to protect the Saudis. And the Saudis need our help for the simple reason the Islamic State that are Sunnis want to overthrow, first and foremost, the Saudi royal family. But they consider any secular state that you have, for example, in Egypt, as well as in Saudi Arabia, where they consider the royal family corrupt. So they want to overthrow the royal family, the Saudis, in Saudi Arabia. They want to overthrow the military regime in Egypt. And then the question is, well, what about Turkey? And that's a good question, because who has been supporting the Islamic State by allowing oil, for example, to come into Turkey and the Islamic State selling it? A large part of their revenue comes from oil on the black markets, as well as having people that want to fight for the Islamic State going through Turkey into either Syria and then into Iraq. You see, Turkey is in a difficult situation. We had a major explosion that killed a demonstration, a peace demonstration, and the people marching were predominantly Kurds. There is a significant Kurd population in Turkey, as there is in Syria and Iraq and a smaller one in Iran. You see, the problem is this. Turkey is in the process of breaking up because they have divisions in their country. It's only a matter of time before that happens. And what needs to emerge over time is a Kurdish state. And you could have upwards of 25 to 30 million population if you take pieces of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey and form a Kurdish state. Remember, the Kurds are primarily in Turkey, they're primarily in the eastern portions of Turkey. And you have competing groups amongst the Kurds as well. What I'm getting to is this. You need a clear, articulated foreign policy that is clear to our enemies as well as clear to our allies. And you need to lead and make very clear what we will do and what we will not do. Much of this should be done in private, but private in the sense that you make it clear to the leadership in each of these countries, but you also have to make it clear to the American people, what are you up to? See, Obama has given a lot of mixed signals over the years he's been in office, and that's part of his problem, messaging. Now, what got me, it was almost pathetic. I'm listening to this interview, or I listened to part of it, I'm primarily reading, and I'm looking for that portion of the interview. I really do want to read this. Regarding leadership, what does Obama want to lead on? And I fell out of my seat, not surprised, but I couldn't believe he would say this with a straight face, because I think he's delusional. That's a polite way of saying he's out of his mind. He wants to lead on climate change. He wants to lead on climate change. We should be the world leader on climate change. He's a damn fool leftist. That's what he is. He's a fool. People are laughing at him, and they should be laughing at him. People aren't buying the climate change nonsense. That is an effort by former socialists, social democrats, communists, to try to tear down free market capitalism and use the environment to do it by restricting developed countries' use of energy, in particular fossil fuels, oil, natural gas. That's what it's about. It's to destroy capitalist nations. That is their agenda. It has nothing to do with science or climate change. Climate change is the pretext to do this. You can cripple any nation by not letting them use the natural resources that they have. What does the United States have plenty of? Coal, natural gas, oil, and finally, hydraulic power or water. Because of the revolution, if you will, in the last few years, this is recent, massive reserves of natural gas and oil have been found. And to the extent that they're on private lands, they've been explored, developed, and are producing. Today, the United States is the leader in terms of reserves of oil and natural gas. What we haven't been able to do, because of Obama's policies, belief that climate change is the threat, is develop federal lands and build pipelines. Any industrial nation, including ours, including China's, India, Russia, you need energy. And you can't get the energy from windmills or solar panels. They're simply inefficient. And when the wind isn't blowing, they're not producing electricity. And when the sun isn't shining, they're not producing electricity. That's why only a fraction of our energy, electrical power, is from those two sources. It's primarily natural gas, coal, nuclear power, and hydropower. And China, India, and the other developing countries are not going to be stopped, nor will they do anything about the so-called threat of man-made warming due to using fossil fuels. What China is doing, India doing today, is they're building coal-fired power plants as well as nuclear plants as fast as they can. Why? They know if they want to expand their industrial base, employ their population, they need electrical power. And they don't have the money to spend on things like scrubbers to take out the particulate matter from coal. And Obama has a problem, as do the what I call the watermelons. They're green on the outside. They're all environmental extremists. And they're red on the inside. They're leftists. They're socialists. They don't believe in free market capitalism that has provided the highest standard of living in the world to the American people. Not communism, not socialism, not a mixed or dual system. It is free market enterprise that has enabled the United States, as well as other countries such as Japan, Switzerland, United Kingdom, to have the standards of living that they have. Barack Obama is using climate change to undermine the U.S. economy, its growth, and continued prosperity by pushing for power being generated by solar panels and windmills. And we have them in Texas. I've taken several trips to West Texas, to Lubbock, to Odessa. And if you drive those highways, you will see these big wind turbines. They make a lot of noise. The only thing, they're in the middle of a desert. In other words, there are very few people around there. There are few, but not many. Yes, there are cities, but the people are in the cities supporting some of the farms and really ranches around there. But it's largely desert, very much like the Middle East, Iraq, for example. So if you put these wind turbines in the middle of nowhere, no one's really going to complain. You put them near a city, people complain real quick. The problem is they're not efficient, because when you don't have the wind, and there's a lot of wind there, but you have periods when the wind's not blowing. If it's not blowing, those turbines are not turning. And if it's real cloudy, those solar panels are not generating electricity. I would love to have a house, for example, that was totally off the grid. The problem is when you start to look to what that would cost and what's the payback period, solar panels are simply not efficient. They don't have the efficiency they need to make economic sense. Most people would really jump at it if it were priced cheaply. And it's not. They're expensive. And it usually takes about at least 15 to 20 years for the payback. You don't know how long these panels are going to be working. You need batteries. That's one of the problems to store the energy. What I'm leading to is this. It's 2 points. The answer is not solar panel or wind turbines. That's a joke. Any industrial country today, such as the United States, India, China, Brazil, it's going to be powered by fossil fuels or nuclear fuels, where fossil fuels could be coal, it could be natural gas, it could be oil, as well as nuclear. The most efficient by far and the cheapest by far is nuclear. You see, these environmentalists, they're against nuclear, they're against coal, they're against natural gas, they're against oil. The only thing that they will agree about is solar panels and turbines that simply cannot power an industrial base, a large industrial base. And if you go the route of 100% solar panels, it's prohibitively expensive. It's the wrong way to go. And the American people are not going to stand for it. They know this is garbage because for the last 18 years, we haven't been warming. And I'm not making this a show because I've done at least a dozen on man-made climate change. But let me summarize as briefly as I can. The predictions of rising temperatures and rising tides are based on computer climate models. They make projections, some would call it predictions, but projections of how high temperatures will rise over the next 100 years or more, as well as how high the tides will rise. Well, what's the problem? If you compare actual temperatures to what the models are predicting, and I'll try to put a graphic. I have a number of excellent charts on this that I've used on other shows, and I'll probably, if I remember, I'll put it in my notes. The models are way high. They're wrong. The models are wrong. Why are they wrong? They think that other factors will amplify the effect of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide by a factor of 3. They need that amplification effect of 3. What's the problem? The amplification effect is not 3. It's about 0.5. And as a result, that's in essence why the models are wrong. And you can see it in the charts. There are literally dozens of these climate models. They all have these predictions, high, low, and medium span going out years, decades. And if you compare it with reality, what actually has happened, the numbers are way up here and reality is way down at the bottom. In other words, it's a load of BS. They really don't know what's going on. Why? They don't understand cloud formation. They don't really understand precipitation. In other words, they don't know the mechanisms involved in terms of climate change. And that's why they're wrong. And when the science can't predict your theory or your hypothesis is wrong, what do? You look for a better one. You look for more data. See, the problem is this. The United Nations, and it's that annually does the report. The name is escaping me for a minute. They believe it's one cause that's driving these rising temperatures. And that one cause is man. Man's activity in terms of using electrical power as well as using fossil fuels to power their vehicles is the cause of the rising temperatures. It's a one-cause model. What's wrong with that? Climate is driven by multiple causes, at least a dozen, and man is a minor, small, I would say almost immaterial, if not irrelevant, cause. The major driver by far is the sun. Then you have cosmic rays, and you have volcanoes, and on and on and on. In other words, their model or models are simply wrong. And that's the basis of the president saying that is our threat? He doesn't know the science. He doesn't understand the science. He's an ideologue. He's a far leftist ideologue that's pushing the big lie, and it's a big lie, that climate change is a threat. No, it's not. The answer to climate change is very simple. You adapt. And what do I mean about that? I'm in Texas. In the summer, it's very hot in Texas. So what do? We wear short sleeve shirts, short sleeve pants. We turn on our air conditionings in our house and in our car. And then when it gets cold in the winter, we turn the air conditioning off. We turn up the heat. We turn up the heat in the car. We wear long sleeve shirts, pants, coats. You adapt. And that's what mankind has been doing since he's been on this planet. He has been adapting. You simply cannot change the weather, and you cannot change the climate. And if you try, you're on a fool's errand. President Obama is promoting a big lie. It's propaganda, folks. It is simply propaganda that would cripple the United States if our government was foolish enough to pick up on his suggestions. That simply is not going to happen. I found the quote that I was looking for. And let me read it. Again, this is President Barack Obama. Quote, "Well, Steve, I've got to tell you, if you think that running your economy into the ground and having to send troops in order to prop up your only ally is leadership, then you've got a different definition of leadership." He's referring to Russia sending in aircraft, troops, tanks into Syria. Now he continues, listen to this. "My definition of leadership would be leading on climate change, an international accord that potentially we will get in Paris. My definition of leadership is mobilizing the entire world community to make sure that Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon. On climate change, he's simply a fool, and its impact will be negligible. The problem is he negotiated an agreement with Iran which will enable Iran sometime in the next 15 years to stockpile multiple nuclear weapons." Now, if you listen to the show, you know, I believe, again, by research reporting, that Iran most likely has one or more nuclear weapons. They haven't tested them, but they will. Iran is playing our president and our secretary of state for fools. They'll take their money. And remember, a lot of this is their money. Most of it's their money that's been frozen in accounts not only in the United States, but also abroad, mainly in Europe. They will take that money, and a large part of it will prop up the current regime, the mullahs. They have a theocracy. They use religion to control their people. It's a theocracy. They will use a lot of that money, first on themselves, but secondly, to provide weapons, for example, to their proxies in Syria and Lebanon, namely the Hezbollah, provide them weapons, as well as other terrorist groups. In other words, they're going to kill more Americans and more of our allies. But the real threat to the American people is that nuclear agreement. This will give Iran a guaranteed path to nuclear weapons, and that will lead to nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. That is where that agreement is heading. The only thing that's going to stop it is the election of a Republican president that will either tear up this agreement or make sure that Iran follows it. And the first time they're out of line, what they will do is reinstitute sanctions. But ultimately, what is going to happen is this. The United States, together with Israel, will have to destroy the nuclear infrastructure of Iran, which means bombing and attacking their command and control centers, their radars, their missiles, and take out their underground facilities, research facilities, where they're building the bombs. And you'll wake up one morning and you'll hear that Israel has attacked the Islamic Republic of Iran and has significantly destroyed portions of those facilities. They're spread out. And it's not an easy mission. I'm not saying that this is a piece of cake. It's not. The problem Israel has, first of all, they need long-range tanker aircraft that can refuel the fighter and attack and bomber aircraft that they're going to need to take out Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And that's why, really, it makes more sense to have a united effort by the Israeli Defense Forces, as well as the United States Air Force, the United States Navy, to go in and completely decimate and destroy the nuclear capability of Iran. Now, I'm a non-interventionist, except where the American people are directly threatened. And because Iran is the leading sponsor of state terrorism, it's only a matter of time, years, but time, before one or more of those nuclear weapons are given to a terrorist and exploded either in Europe or in the United States. And that is what our president has done. Everyone that looks into that thinks our president is out of his mind. He intended to do this when he walked into the White House. I think ultimately what we're going to find out, and I have suspected this since 2007, that Barack Obama is what's called an agent of influence. The question is, an agent of influence of what country or what religion? Is it Russia? Is it Saudi Arabia? Is it Iran? Is it Communist China? Is it the Muslim Brotherhood? I don't know. I raise this for a simple reason. People that are much smarter than me and have access to highly classified information cannot understand what Barack Obama is doing. It directly is not in our national interest to do this. We don't want a nuclear Iran, and what Secretary Kerry and Obama has done is enabled that, made it a lot easier. You see, Barack Obama does not want the United States to engage militarily in the Middle East. And he's building up Iran to be a counterweight to both the Arabs and Israel. And the Arabs and Israeli government understands that. He's taking the deliberate side of Iran. And you got to understand that the regime there is despised by its people. It's a theocracy that is authoritarian. It's really totalitarian. You don't want to live there. Its people don't like the mullahs, detest the leadership, and really want to overthrow it. But who has all the guns? Who has all the weapons? The people in power. Oh, yes, Barack Obama would like to take our weapons, but the American people won't allow it. I'm looking at the time. I'm going to have to wrap this up. So if you have time, what I suggest to do is watch the entire interview. Now, it was more than just foreign affairs, although when Barack Obama has the nerve to say it's climate change and Iran, he's beyond delusional. He will must much of his legacy, and I think he knows this. If the Democrats cannot elect a Democratic president, much, if not all, of his legacy will be destroyed, including Obamacare, including the Iran nuclear deal, and we're definitely going to have to rebuild a lot of bridges with our allies, but America is going to come back. Now, here's the dilemma I'm in. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, and I believe in a non-interventionist foreign policy. I'm not buying into the neocon nonsense that we should be policemen of the world and we should be spreading democracy. It doesn't work that way. Down that road lies failure, and it's not recognizing the fact that they haven't looked at the United States' financial situation in terms of not only the national debt but unfunded liabilities, because we simply don't have the money. Even if I thought it was a good idea, we don't have the money, and it's hard for them to get the neocons to get it in their head. But they understand the hard reality. The American people do not want to go back to the Middle East, period. Stay out. What we need to do is minimize the dangers of the Islamic State as well as Iran. What I see happening, whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration, the United States is going to go back to using the CIA. As a matter of fact, they're still using the CIA to overthrow regimes. In other words, try to keep as low as profile as possible, but try to influence people, both in Iran, Iraq, Syria, to overthrow regimes that are unfriendly or enemies of the United States. And that's what Obama, to a limited extent, has been doing. Doesn't want to talk about it, wants to talk about climate change and his so-called legacy of Iranian nuclear deal that the overwhelming majority of people don't like. And the Republicans, in their infinite stupidity, should have insisted in following the treaty clause of the United States Constitution and required him to get 67 votes. Instead, because of the lack of leadership, and leadership is the big deficit in Washington, D.C. We don't have leadership in Congress. We don't really have leadership in our president. We have a bunch of talkers. The American people want results, good results. They're not getting them. That's why for example, a Donald Trump is attracting a lot of attention. And I'm of the opinion, and Donald Trump is not my first choice, by the way, but Donald Trump most likely will be our next president of the United States. And we're in for some real change, and it's about time. And both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party deserve what they get. So if the American people are persuaded by the arguments of Donald Trump, much, if not all, of what President Obama has been lying about, promoting, whether it's Obamacare, the Iranian nuclear deal, his failed foreign policy in both Libya, Syria, Egypt, Iraq, Afghanistan, all of that will change, hopefully for the better. With that, let me play America the Beautiful. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.